Good evening and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Maurice Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome you to another wonderful evening author event that I think makes this series the intellectual treasure chest for the city of Philadelphia. There are a couple of things that I want to mention before I comment about our speaker tonight. One is that this is an incredible week, I think, for Philadelphia and for this lecture series. I mean, you have General Hayden here tonight. You have the woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize talking about Iran here on Wednesday night. And you have a specialist on Israel here on Thursday night. So what an incredible National Security Week that Andy Cahan and his staff have put together. I encourage you to look at their names: Andy Cahan, Laura Kovacs, Jason Freeman, Paul Bednar. Let's give them a round of applause, but they do a wonderful job. The second thing is that I hope you read the Inquirer yesterday. There was a front page article about the branch system that we're trying to raise money to modernize. Many of them are old Carnegie libraries that have not been really updated. It talked about water leaks and other challenges that need to be addressed. And so there's ample opportunity to make contributions to the Free Library, to the renovation of the branch system. There's ample opportunity for each of us in our wills to put in a simple statement to provide a gift as a legacy to the importance of the libraries and the bridge building that they provide to the citizens of Philadelphia, whether it be in terms of entertainment, education, computer access. The branch system does an incredible job, I think, on behalf of all the citizens of Philadelphia. Tonight, as you know, we have Michael Hayden, General Michael Hayden, with us playing to the edge. I urge you to buy two copies, one for yourself, have him sign upstairs after the talk, but a second to share with friends, because he's talking about what I think is the critical issue facing America. It's not that we need more tankers or more planes. I think it's a question of what we need in the way of cybersecurity. How many of you think, as I do, that we're engaged in warfare with the likes of Russia or China or Iran or North Korea? Show of hands. Anybody feel that I do, that that's taking place right now? Well, one of the issues is obviously having our elected officials work with people like General Hayden and the CIA to update the rules and regulations that can take place to help us to more efficiently protect ourselves. And when he talks about playing to the edge, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about the CIA and other security organizations operating within the framework of the rules and guidelines that they're given, but it's their job to play to the edge to provide as much security and focus for all of us. You don't know, in terms of the program, he's a native of Pittsburgh. His first job was working for the Pittsburgh Steelers, so you can imagine that he has a lifelong affection for the Steelers, and he's a graduate of Duquesne University. But since then, of course, he's spent his career as an intelligence officer in the Air Force, rising to the rank of a four-star general, and then stepping down from that to take on the responsibility heading up to CIA for 3 years. He's going to be interviewed by our own Michael Smirkanish of TV and writing fame. And so please join me in giving them a wonderful Philadelphia Free Library welcome.
General, when several months ago the Free Library invited me to moderate this conversation, we were having dinner. You met two of our sons tonight, and I described who you were, who you are, and one of them said, "Oh, I get it, Dad. He's Saul Berenson."
I welcome the comparison.
Having read the book, they don't do such a bad job.
No, they don't. No, actually, People have asked me, do you watch Homeland? And it's like, I never miss an episode. But to quickly summarize, all the stuff in the foreground, the details, all wrong. You pull out a cell phone at Langley, you're going to end up with your nose down in the concrete as the security guys come by. But all the stuff in the background, Michael, the kind of the obsession on mission, the modest sense of isolation, us, them, the teamwork, the camaraderie, the self-identification with mission and agency, all correct. I was out at Santa Fe with a Jeff Bezos conversation kind of like this, and I got this question, and I quickly said, and Kerry worked for me. I said, all right, minus the sex, the drugs, and the bipolar thing. but Kerry worked for me. And I came down off stage a few minutes later, and George Tenet, one of my predecessors, was there with his wife, Stephanie. George walks up to me, put his arms over my shoulder, pulls his mouth to my ear, and says her name. He knew exactly who I was talking about.
Everybody in the room, everybody listening to this, remembers exactly where they were on September 11. You describe in the book, you were at Fort Meade. I was trying a case 3 blocks away in City Hall here in Philadelphia. As a layperson, I thought it was an air traffic control mistake when they first reported it. How long thereafter did you know it's Al-Qaeda?
When my executive assistant came in and said a plane hit the other tower. And I turned to her immediately and said, get the head of security up here. And as he was coming in a few minutes later, my EA, Cindy Farkas, was coming in saying there are reports of an explosion on the mall. That's the D.C. mall. That's a garbo of the plane hitting the Pentagon. My poor security chief still hasn't spoken. I mean, he just comes in. He's looking at me. I say, Kemp, all non-essential. Send them home. And he did an about-face. Sent non-essential personnel home. There are about 15,000 people who work at Fort Meade for NSA. Rough estimate, 2/3 went home, 1/3 stayed. So we had 1,000 people there. And what I did, Michael, was ordered an evacuation of the high-rises. You think back to that Will Smith movie, all those ominous scenes of NSA with those two buildings. Those are the new buildings, about 8 stories tall. I told everybody out of those and into the original building, which is a low-rider, 3 stories for reasons that should be obvious. That's where our op center is anyway. So I went and decamped there very briefly. About dusk, my chief of signals intelligence said, you got to go talk to the counterterrorism people. So I did. They were still in the high rise because Fort Meade is the NSA headquarters, but it's also the biggest field station. And so when I say the CT people, I don't mean people following reports. I mean people with headsets on. They are doing mission. And we can't move them. I mean, you can't afford the gap in capacity as you move them out of a building. So I walked in. Most of them Arab Americans, feeling then, therefore, the national trauma, the professional trauma, and then because they were Arab Americans, the personal trauma of what was going on. And I walked around, I didn't say much, hand on shoulder, nod, and so on. But what I will never forget, as I walked in, it was dusk, and you remember along the eastern seaboard, it was just a brilliantly clear day, and the sun was setting, and as I walked in, part of the logistics force was tacking up blackout curtains because we couldn't move them. They were still in the high-rise, and I still remember the thought, we're putting up blackout curtains in eastern Maryland in the 21st century. It's going to be different.
Title of the book is Playing to the Edge. Who determines what the edge is?
The American political process. Well, we actually have a healthy political process, and I realize, you know, we've got issues. But we do have processes. We do have a constitution. We argue on the edges all the time. That's what makes us Americans. But there is a political... I said something earlier today. You know, when the guy standing behind the catcher in that blue outfit has a ball that looks like it's on the black of the outside corner of the plate, looks like it's on the knees, he doesn't get to say, oh, too close to call, try another pitch there, big guy. Okay, he's got to call it a ball or a strike. And we have processes set up to call balls and strikes. In other words, we have processes set up to draw the lines. The lines are always controversial. All right? The lines move. They legitimately move based upon your will, based upon our understanding of the threat, based upon the totality of circumstances in which we find ourselves. The lines do move. But there's got to be a definitive line. When Barack Obama became president, he closed the CIA black sites and ended our enhanced interrogation program, a decision that I opposed. But, Michael, on that day, I sent a message to the entire CIA workforce. The president has given us everything that we need. He has given us clear guidance. These lines are different than the old lines, but we will respect these lines and we will be as aggressive as possible within the new lines that have been drawn for us.
But the ultimate line is the Fourth Amendment, right? A prohibition
right.
against
unreasonable
search and seizure.
Right.
Shouldn't, I'll take your metaphor, shouldn't the strike zone have been the same the morning of as it was that afternoon?
Oh, God, no. No. You and I aren't protected against search and seizure. We're protected against unreasonable search and seizure. And reasonableness is based upon the totality of circumstances in which we find ourselves. How many of you would have found it reasonable to take your clothes off at Philadelphia International on September 8th or September 9th? But following September 11th, we found that to be a reasonable trade-off in terms of our privacy in return for increased security. I actually, and it's detailed in the book, so I'll just reference it, Michael. I actually changed some of the rules under which NSA operates under my own authority, fully within my authority, on the afternoon of September 11th because things were different. I actually gave NSA a little more running room to report on U.S.-related communications going to or coming from Afghanistan, because we had just been attacked from an opposing armed enemy force headquartered in Afghanistan. So, yeah, it moves.
So if the strike zone is somewhat fungible, does Edward Snowden deserve any credit for the role that he played in contributing to the debate as to what that strike zone would be?
Yeah, so here's how I summarize it, okay? He accelerated a necessary conversation. He distorted it, okay? And the other 98% of what he revealed had nothing to do with the Fourth Amendment. It had everything to do with how America collects foreign intelligence. Harsh judgment, but I'll stand by it.
I want to walk through this chronologically using September 11 as the benchmark. And let me ask this as a sort of preamble. Pre-internet, pre-smartphone world, was there any methodology analogous to metadata collection?
Yeah, it was called traffic analysis. And so you got the SOVs out there communicating, and they're pretty good at this, so they have unbreakable encryption. So we never get to the content of what it is they're saying. But, you know, if the Strategic Rocket Forces communications network lights up and we have intense communications traffic, even though we never get to content, we're going, whoa, what could this be about? And so the metadata has a lineal ancestor in traffic analysis. Now, I fully admit that what we did with metadata in the world we now live in which you and I have so much digital exhaust, all right, that we have used a lot more metadata in order to create actionable intelligence, even when we never get to the content of a communication.
And the guidelines that had up until that point been provided by the court no longer seemed to fit the modern example, even though there was that 1979 case
right.
that I know you're familiar with,
yep.
the Smith v. Maryland case,
yep.
the woman who gets robbed,
yep.
the guy calls her on the phone. Did that enter into your thinking?
Oh, absolutely. No.
Speak to that.
Sure.
So
I know we've got a lot to cover, so I'll be efficient here.
Okay.
For 200 years, we have tried as a people to balance our security and liberty, our safety and our privacy, by simply saying, all right, all that intelligence stuff over here, all the law enforcement stuff over here, all the foreign stuff in that corner, all the domestic stuff in that corner. And what happened on September 11th is the 19 hijackers drove right through that wedge, right through that gap between foreign and domestic intelligence and law enforcement. So the challenge we had, Michael, was, by the way, not just from the president, but from the Congress, was close the gap, dummy. All right, we just lost 3,000 people. And so we had to figure out a way to close the gap. And we hit upon metadata as the lightest touch on American privacy that would allow us to close the gap between foreign and domestic law enforcement and intelligence. And we did rely on the decision you just referred to, Smith versus Maryland, 1979, 5-3. Metadata is not constitutionally protected. You do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy about your metadata because, frankly, the metadata is not yours. It belongs to the phone company.
I mean, interesting case where this woman is robbed. You correct me if I'm wrong, but the robber then torments her with telephone calls, and they want to install a device so that they can capture who's making this call.
Who's making, not the content.
Who's making, right.
Yeah.
So this had to enter into your thinking as to what can we do?
Oh, no, it did. But again, as an article of faith, right, I mean, we pay attention to the Supreme Court at NSA. And as an article of faith, the court had decided that metadata was not constitutionally protected. So we looked at it. All right, if we got to go, we didn't do it arbitrarily on September 10th. We're faced with a problem post-September 11th, and we do have this court judgment that we've got more running room in order to use even American metadata in order to make ourselves more safe because of the court decision. Now, I fully get it if the court revisits this issue, given the current power of metadata, the current ubiquity of metadata, the court may change its mind. But, you know, let me just reveal my own prejudices. I hope the court revisits Roe v. Wade. But until it does, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, and I expect the government to act in accordance with Roe v. Wade the same way we acted in accordance with Smith v. Maryland.
So we're obviously doing the speed read here. It's a wonderful book, by the way.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed the level of detail. And for those who've not yet had the privilege of reading it, all of these things are dealt with and further explained.
Yeah.
In the immediate aftermath of September 11, George Tenet comes to you and he says, what else can we do?
Yeah, actually, so I did that tweak on the afternoon of September 11th. It's in the book. It has to do with minimization of U.S. identities. It's really out there on the edge. But I called George, who's the director of Central Intelligence. By the way, I called the Congress, and I told them. George goes in, part of his daily brief to President and Vice President. He actually says, oh, one more thing, Mr. President. Mike Hayden's going to jail. Okay. And Vice President Cheney kindly says, well, we'll bail him out. And then George briefly explains what I'm doing. And President Bush says, good. Is there anything else he could be doing? So George then calls me. Mike, President, Vice President, jail, bail you out. Can you do anything more? The president wants to know. And I say, George, no, not consistent with my current authorities. And Tenet says, not exactly the question I asked you.
He tells you you've got a blank slate.
He says to me, what more can you do? I said, I'll get back to you. So I go to my guys. We huddle up. We come with a package. Metadata is one element of it. We take it downtown. And the president, operating under his raw Article II commander-in-chief authorities, authorizes us to do this. We then insist, and this is an interesting footnote, Michael, we then insist that you got to tell Congress. And within 3 weeks of starting this, we brief a very small group of Congress that we are operating in a new legal regime based upon what justice says is the president's Article II authorities. And before you rush to judgment, it's the same kind of rhythm under which the current president authorizes targeted killings, even against U.S. citizens. He has authority as commander-in-chief.
One of the things that occurred to me when reading that part of the book, this all happens very quickly.
It does.
That which we're now describing. So it's not as if, was it M or Q? Who in the Bond movies was the guy with all the gadgetry?
Q.
Okay. So whoever
I know that.
Whoever your Q was, they were there at the ready.
Oh, no.
And it made me wonder, what else can you do?
Yeah, if I could have done something then, I would have suggested it. And so what we offered, there are three broad lanes of approach that we used. Two of them had to do with metadata. One had to do with content, clearly different than what we were doing prior. but carefully constrained, carefully overseen. Honest men can differ. I get that, all right? But that was about it.
So you then...
Oh, by the way, in 2006 and 2008, with the Protect America Act and the FISA Amendment Act, Congress actually legislates things I would not have dared to ask for in October of 2001.
Such as?
The 702 program, the ability of the United States to go to U.S. Internet service providers and demand emails that are in America but not of America, if you understand the distinction. They're not yours, they're someone else's, but they're sitting here.
After Tenet asks you what else you got, and you tell him this, yeah. You then go back to the Oval Office for the briefing, of the president on what the metadata collection will be.
Right.
You didn't, however, and tell me if I'm wrong, you didn't, however, ask the president to see evidence of what he believed to be his constitutional Article II ability to actually do this. You took it as a leap of faith.
No. I went with the president and said, here's what we could technically accomplish if we had the authority. Now, the question becomes, do you have the authority as the president? And again, justice. So this creates a memo from the president that gets recreated every 45 days based upon the serious threat, actually, to the continuity of government that we thought Al-Qaeda represented, authorizing me to do the things I recommended, co-signed by the Attorney General, saying that indeed the President's Article II authorities allow him to authorize this, then went to the Secretary of Defense to direct me to do it, and then the order every 45 days was brought to me
right, but General,
to do
you,
it.
Your fanny was on the line.
Oh, yeah.
I was surprised that you didn't say, Mr. President, we now know it was John Yoo.
Yeah.
Who was writing the memos.
Okay, I see where you're going.
And,
okay.
And I'm wondering why you didn't, as a matter of self-preservation, say, hey, can I have the data, the memo,
sure.
That suggests this is... And further, when your guys then go to the vice president's office, to Mr. Addington, because he's the one calling the shot, and your attorneys ask to see the memos that justify this, they're shut down.
It wasn't my attorneys. It was my inspector general, who later went. And it's about 18 months later. So in the continuous play now, late September, early October, all right, I present the options to the president. I get a clear sense, and I say in the book, I'm driving back from the White House, and I call my lawyer at NSA saying, come see me in the office as soon as I get back. I go into the office. This is a lawyer I trust with my life. And I say, Bob, he's going to authorize this on his own hook. He's going to authorize this on his Article II authorities. I want your view. Do you think he has the authority to do this? And you have to understand that NSA lawyers have a well-deserved reputation for being very conservative. So Bob mulled over for the night, came in the next morning, and I recount it in the book. He says, yeah, I think he does. And Bob went to his two most senior lawyers serially and privately, and each independently said, no, I actually think the president's Article II authorities give him the ability to do this. That's what I needed, Michael.
So you get an order every 45 days.
Right.
All of a sudden, there's a fly in the ointment because Alberto Gonzalez is the acting attorney general, and he's not willing to sign it.
Jim Comey, pardon me.
Did that cause you any pause to say, geez, I better make sure that I'm all fours?
This is the March 2004 breathless run up the staircase
right.
At GW Hospital with the Attorney General John Ashcroft near death,
right.
Jim Comey refusing to sign. So to kind of parse that was about one aspect of the program, not the overall program. It was about a narrow aspect. And Jim objected to the one aspect of the program, not because it wasn't a good idea, but, Michael, he didn't think it was discriminate enough, that it actually was foreign targeted. But because of the nature of the collection, it was pulling in what we call incidental collection, which meant some of your stuff and my stuff. And again, we're back to the Constitution. What is reasonable? All right. My lawyers thought that the degree of incidental collection, which, of course, we then discarded. I'm sorry. You have to understand. If you can access X, you only collect a portion of X. If you collect a portion of X, you only process a portion of a portion. I mean, the funnel gets more narrow. So you start throwing out the stuff that you're not authorized to have as you get a better window as to what it is you've picked up. And that's a standard. That happens all the time. It may sound alarming in my retelling, but that's just the nature of this business. And what Jim thought was, out here at the collection, we're just pulling in too much incidental stuff. My guys thought, no, that's actually reasonable. And that was the argument. Jim refused to sign. So we had a meeting in the White House on a Thursday afternoon. We had the congressional leadership there, whom actually I came away from the meeting saying they were broadly, your problem, White House, but they were broadly supportive of what we were doing, but your problem, White House. Beyond my view, Al Gonzalez and Andy Card go try to visit Ashcroft in GW Hospital. He's got pancreatitis, and there's a dramatic scene, Comey running up the stairs, Bob Mueller. In any event, the order does not get signed for the lawfulness of this one aspect. I get asked the next morning, it's all detailed in the book, as you suggest, I get asked the next morning, are you willing to carry this forward with only the White House counsel averring to its lawfulness rather than the acting attorney general? Overnight, about a dozen backpack bombs had gone off on a variety of trains in Madrid, Spain, killing hundreds of Spaniards. It affected my judgment. And I said, all right, I mean, this has been chaotic. This is all compressed in a very short period of time. I think I got political support from Congress. My guys think that it's perfectly legal. I got a stack of these orders where it's been declared legal for 3 years now. And I told the White House, all right, let's do it. I'll do it based upon Al Gonzalez saying it's okay, which means the president says it's okay, which actually is the definitive word, according to U.S. law. And we'll go with it one more time. All right. Fast forwarding, Comey and Bob Mueller threatened to resign. I don't think the president was as concerned about Comey, but he really respected Mueller. So the president comes to me and says, I don't want to go against Mueller. How long would it take you to turn it off? I go, big ship, small rudder, 10 days. He said, okay, shut it off. I'm being cartoonish. I mean, it's just working through staff, all right? And then I say, what do you want me to do with the stuff I've collected? Don't throw it away. Keep it. And then we stopped that one aspect of the program. We then went to the FISA court, argued this issue out in front of the FISA court. I'm sorry, we're really pulling you through a real knot hole here, right? But in essence, rather than doing this thing under the president's raw authority, we tried to go do it under the court. We still had the reasonableness challenge and whether or not the collection was precise enough. The court agreed with us. And by the late summer of 2004, we were pretty much up and running with what was contentious, but doing it under a court order rather than under the president's raw Article II authorities. And then to round out the story, I've got a stack of those 45-day orders post mid-2004 with Jim Comey's signature on them. That comes out like a criticism of Jim. I don't mean that. We maintain good relationships throughout. This was a question of principle. But at the end of the day, we had gotten a new equilibrium, even if we had this really tumultuous, turbulent seas episode from about March to July.
What's the biggest misconception among the public about the metadata program?
Yeah, the biggest misconception is what it is we do with it. Then back to accelerated the debate but distorted it, all right? And he didn't do it himself. I mean, the Glenn Greenwalds and Laura Poitras of the world helped. They shove out the story that NSA's got all your phone bills. Actually, they didn't say that. They actually said NSA's collecting your metadata. We'd never collected your metadata. Sorry, this is going to sound like I'm a Jesuit arguing here, but we acquired your metadata. Collecting your metadata means we got alligator clips on your phone line. All we did was go to the companies and say, you collect this because you want to get their money. Give us their phone records. So in essence, what we got from the phone companies were billing records. And I freely admit, it was trillions of call events. And that's scary. I get it. But then the question, which was not asked, is what then happens to it? And most people assumed that we treated it like Google, Apple, or Microsoft treats it, which means they mine it for your relationships and no, we never did. It's, for want of a better term, in a lockbox, okay, over here. And we access it under only very narrowly prescribed circumstances. How many people had access to the lockbox? 22. All their activity was constantly keystroke monitored. And what authorized access to the lockbox? They had what they believed to be a dirty number, a reasonable, articulable suspicion that this number here is a dirty number. We call it a seed number. You know, you raid a safe house in Yemen, you roll up some people, they got pocket litter, it looks like they're Al-Qaeda, they got a cell phone you've never seen before, you walk up to the transom with this gajillion record database and say, hey, anybody in here talk to this phone here in Yemen? And if a number over in South Philly kind of goes, well, yeah, I do every Thursday. NSA then gets to say, well, who the hell do you talk to? I am now done explaining what happens to the data. That's it. Anything further has to get turned over to the FBI under routine law enforcement. Now, I get it. At the end of that explanation, and I can fill in the fine print, I'm not, but I could, all right? At the end of that, a lot of people in this audience are going to say, huh, I didn't understand that. I still don't like it. I don't want you doing it. I got that. But that is not, Michael, the general understanding of what happened.
Two questions unrelated about two supposed allies. Before the 9/11 Commission, there was a congressional inquiry into the events of September 11. There are 28 pages that pertain to potential Saudi involvement with regard to the hijackers. The American public has still not seen the 28 pages. Yeah. President Obama promised 9/11 victim family members that we would. Should we?
I don't know what's in the 28, all right? So my instinct is, yeah, of course. But I don't know what's in the 28, all right?
But what could it be?
Well, it might be politically embarrassing, but not evidence of criminal activity. Well, relationships matter. I already told you I support transparency here, all right? I have no evidence of any Saudi government involvement in knowledge of anything with regard to 9/11. Now, I'm willing to sit here for the rest of the evening and talk about the deal that the kingdom has made with the devil in terms of their relationship with radical Wahhabism and how that has distorted Saudi political, diplomatic, and religious policy. I got all that. But I don't have any reason to believe that there is a Saudi government connection to anything with regard to 9/11.
Do you believe that the ISI was complicit in bin Laden being in Abbottabad?
No, I don't. Which does not mean I don't have my grief with ISI. This is the Pakistani Intelligence Service. So he asked me about Homeland. Remember season 4, 5, all set in Pakistan, right? Remember this? Let me give you my summary. They were far too easy on the ISI, okay? Okay, this is the ally from hell. That said, I have no reason to believe that any, let me be careful with my words here, higher reaches of the Pakistani government were aware of or supportive of bin Laden being in Abbottabad. I have a little trouble understanding how the Postmaster General in Abbottabad didn't have his suspicions. Okay? But I just don't have evidence, Michael, that it's higher up new.
You are erroneously blamed for waterboarding. The last waterboarding, only three incidents,
right.
Let's make it real clear, was in 2003. You were still at the NSA. You were not yet at the CIA. But when you get to the CIA, and even today, and certainly in the book, you are very defensive of all of those enhanced interrogation techniques.
Yeah.
Speak to waterboarding
sure.
in particular.
So waterboarding, the last waterboarding took place more than 3 years prior to my arrival. So I arrived at CIA in May of 2006. The detention and interrogation program is somewhat in stasis. I spend the summer studying it. It is more than a 600-pound animal inside the room, and I've got to figure out a way ahead. And so I studied it. I could have walked away from it. I could have said, that was then, this is now, I'm the new guy. You know. In conscience, I decided that we needed to amend but not end the program. And so what did I do? I went into Steve, and there's actually the part of the book that talks, that has me talking about Steve Hadley is me pretty much writing my notes from the meeting. I found my notes in my files. And I go into Steve and say, number one, Steve, we are not the nation's jailers. We should not be keeping these people forever. We need to empty the black sites. And the administration agreed. And so Labor Day weekend, 06, we fly them from where we had them to Guantanamo. I said, Steve, we should keep the sites open. We need to keep our options open. But we need strict rules about who we take and how long. So we don't take anybody without an exit plan. Okay. We keep people for 60 days. I can extend it, but no longer does it take a decision to get rid of them. It takes a decision to continue to keep them. We had 13 approved techniques. At the end of all this, we skinned it down to 6. And let me be really irreverent, all right? I had 4 of them used on me in Catholic grade school. Okay. Okay. Right. Now the other two, well, no, two of them were grasps. Grasp with the lapel, grasp with the chin, insult slap to the face, tummy slap. Those were 4 of the 6, okay? The other two were non-trivial, diet, manipulation, and sleep deprivation. And you read the book, I authorize extended sleep deprivation. So I'm not trying to dodge the bullet here. But I felt it necessary to draw it back in, Michael. But that was never, to answer your question, that was never a judgment on what went on before. I had my circumstances. Those guys had theirs, right? And when somebody asked me, what would you have done in 2002? My standard answer, it comes from the depth of my heart, is I am very happy that I never had to make that decision then. And a lot of other people around town, that town, not this one, a lot of other people around town ought to be happy too.
Two final questions from me, and then we'll go to the audience, okay? I'm glad you just referenced your Catholicism because I wanted to go there next. There's a scene in the book where you're in Iraq and you're receiving communion, and you take delight in the fact that you're offered the body and blood of Christ, but it's Michael, the yeah. body and blood of Christ. Yeah. So you wear your Catholicism yeah, proudly. I want to know this. Were you in any of your day-to-day activities, and we haven't even gotten to drones, was your faith challenged? Did your faith make you question some of that which you were doing?
But my faith shaped my personal moral conscience, and I had a deep responsibility to myself never to violate my personal moral conscience. So there's a line in the book where I get the phone rings at 2 a.m. and I have a pretty good idea what it is. I literally said to myself, remember, Hayden, whatever it is you decide, you're going to have to live with for the rest of your life. And then I would reach over and grab the phone. By the way, that is not an invitation to conservatism, because if you lowball enough of these decisions and something terrible happens, you're going to live with that decision for the rest of your life, too. That said, I wasn't just Mike Hayden, Catholic kid from the north side of Pittsburgh. I was the head of the nation's Central Intelligence Agency. And although I never did violence to my personal moral personality, I had this additional responsibility. So the worst it ever got, Michael, was I certainly wish I weren't the one who had to make this decision. Okay, my personal self complaining about my professional self. But I never made a professional decision that did violence to my personal self. There's a story in the book about a particularly aggressive covert action that we were considering taking. And my deputy and I, who's also a Catholic, decided we wanted to talk to the president. So we went up to Camp David and sat with President Bush for about an hour, and we walked our way through it. And we raised, well, what about this? What about that? Is this necessary? I mean, there are laws of armed conflict, humanity, necessity, proportionality, distinction. We talked it all through with the president. It was clear to me that when we left, the president's implicit guidance to us, if you guys think it's right to do, we're going to do it. If you guys don't think it's right to do, we will not speak of this again. And we did it.
Finally, from me, at least for now, in a word, the book is unapologetic
yeah.
with regard to the way in which this war has been waged. You don't have a word choice of preference. Do you say radical Islam? What do you say?
No, I do say radical Islam. Okay. And I think we confuse ourselves by pretending that Islam doesn't have anything to do with this.
Okay. Unapologetic is the way that I would summarize the book. There's a presidential candidate who is desirous of there being more arrows in the quiver. And yet you've been very, very critical of him. You were critical of him on my CNN program this weekend.
Yeah.
Is there not overlap between the arguments you make and that which Donald Trump is saying on the campaign trail?
Only to the superficial observer.
We were doing so well.
So he's got one tactic. We got to be really tough. We got to be really tough. We got to kill their families. Let me suggest to you that is not a measure of toughness. Okay? And it, not only is it unworthy of a great nation, it's not really very productive. You're still mad for what they did to us 14 years ago, killing innocents. Why would we want to give them that opportunity to remain angry at us forever because we intentionally targeted non-combatants? I said on Bill Maher, I was actually thinking I was pointing out the laws of gravity. You know, if you'd let something go, it falls. He said, he's going to kill families. I said, no, the American military won't do that. I mean, every ounce of our being is trained not to do that. Now, I do agree we ought to be tougher. I do think our activity against ISIS is under-resourced and over-regulated. I do think we should have a higher tolerance for collateral damage. But that's incidental loss, not intentional loss. Now let's jump to interrogation techniques. We should waterboard them, and a lot more, because they deserve it. Well, number one, we didn't do anything to anybody because they deserved it. Now, I freely admit in the book we weren't very nice to about 3 dozen people, all right? And it's roughly detailed there to the degree I can. But we never did it as an arm of justice. It was never rearward-looking. It was forward-looking. We were trying to gain information we believe they have to keep us safe in the future. He embraces waterboarding with enthusiasm. The agency, when it did it with reluctance and out of duty, not enthusiasm. What it does, Michael, as difficult as these decisions early on were, as controversial as they are, and I understand that many people in the room think that they were just wrong to do, right? But Trump's defense of waterboarding cheapens and belittles the moral decisions that CIA officers had to make in incredibly difficult circumstances.
Can't keep you to myself, General. If you have a question, I'll call on you. All that I ask is please wait for the microphone so that everyone gets to hear exactly what you seek to ask.
In the beginning, you said that it was quite clear right after 9/11 that the attack had come from Afghanistan. Did there come a point where you voiced at least a question as to why we invaded Iraq instead?
I didn't, because I wasn't part. No, number one, we did invade Afghanistan, all right? And so it was not instead, it was in addition to. Okay. There's actually a difference. Okay. I do say in the book that I could see from NSA. First, I'm sorry, let me retreat. At that point in time, the director of NSA was far more technician than he was policy player. All right, that changed as we got more into the cyber thing. And so I really never attended a meeting about whether the United States should or should not go to war in Iraq. Never asked my view. I did attend the meeting on the weapons of mass destruction and the National Intelligence Estimate. And I detail in the book that I voted yes because I believe he did have the program. We were wrong, but you know, that was my involvement. I do say in the book, I kind of transitioned from Afghanistan to Iraq, from I think chapter 3 to chapter 4, that I wondered why we were doing this. Saddam was bad, but he wasn't going anywhere, and we had plenty of work to do. And that's how I end the bridge chapter between Afghanistan and Iraq.
You also refute the idea that this was acquiescing to the vice president.
Oh, yeah.
We just got it wrong.
Oh, no, our bad. And frankly, getting it wrong is bad enough. But what's even worse is if you can, three clicks, you can be on the key judgments at home tonight on the 2002 NIE on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. And if you read it, you'll see that it was wrong. But what will come out at you, I think, is the confidence level that seems to drip from the page we not only got it wrong, we did not communicate any doubt or ambiguity to our clients. And in fact, we had some doubts and some ambiguities. I mean, you know, this wasn't, I mean, it reads like tablets coming down from Sinai, when in reality, they were assessments. And we would have done a far better job of not just getting it right, but also communicating to our clients that, you know, we were more confident about some things than others.
This is going to sound mundane, but when I was 18 and I went into the Navy, I was recruited into the Naval Security Group, in which I learned all sorts of things I never knew before about cryptography. I had a clearance for secret, top secret cryptographic clearance. And what I'm really confused about today is I understood this as a little 18-year-old. Why these politicians today do not understand what is a secure system and what isn't. What is confidential and what isn't.
Yeah.
Can you address that?
Sure. So, I mean, the gentleman introduced himself in our parlance. He's a Navy crippy, all right? And the Navy is very proud of its crippies. They kind of isolate their cryptologic workforce in a narrow career field. They get to be really good at it. So my congratulations. So I think we're talking about somebody's emails here. Is that the issue? Yeah. I'll repeat for you what I said on Morning Joe about 15 months ago. The sin here is the original sin. All right? Once you set this thing up this way, this is Breaking Bad. There is no way you can make this end happy. If you use a private system, and oh, for God's sake, a private server, all right, for your official government correspondence. And Michael and I were talking about this coming in. Where's the permanent government? Where's the Dutch uncle in the front office saying, ma'am, I love you like a sister and I'll die for you, but this just isn't going to happen, all right? Because once you set it up that way, it's going where it's gone, all right? I probably shouldn't say this, but I had an unclassified email system too. It was government. It was CIA. I never accessed my private account from my government office. I used my government unclassified account. I would not want an army of classification specialists walking through thousands of unclassified emails trying to detect the inadvertent or vertent, you know, mentioning of something. But once you've put it over here, that's exactly what's been invited, and that's what's happening.
What's the likelihood that she was hacked?
1.0. I don't have evidence of that. What I say publicly is I would lose respect for dozens of security services around the world if they were not thumbing through all the emails.
Question from this side of the room. Yes, sir, right there. Here comes the mic.
Thanks. On encryption and the current debate, so it seems like on one side of the divide we have the president and many current government officials. On the other side of the encryption debate, we have a lot of the tech community, companies like Apple, and yourself, Secretary Chertoff, and many ex-government officials.
Yep.
So is this a case of, like you said a few times tonight, you have your circumstances and your predecessors and successors have theirs, and where does the divide come from and how might we bridge it?
Yeah, I can't rule out that that's an influencer, but I think it's more complicated. If you notice in government, have you heard many intel guys going to the mats for this? And the answer is no. You got the law enforcement guys, and then at South by Southwest, the president blurts out the one, you know, we got to go there. I actually, this is going to sound too irreverent and maybe slightly political, I think that's up there with Assad has to go, all right? He's made the statement. I don't know if you're going to put any personal or political prestige in making the statement happen, all right? I really don't, all right? Here's my view, and I'll be really efficient. All right. I think the government has the right to demand it, one. Number two, I don't think there are any privacy concerns in that phone. He's dead, and it wasn't his phone. Three, I don't think it's a smart idea for the government to ask Apple to do what the government wants Apple to do. I mean, Apple has a certain degree of unbreakableness in their encryption. And no matter what it is you think is going to be done, the unbreakableness quotient is going down because somebody broke it. It's complicated operating systems, self-destruct mechanisms, brute force attacks. All you need to know is it will be less secure than it would otherwise have been because somebody figured out a way to breast through something, all right? Last 3 years, at least two, maybe three, Jim Clapper, the director of national intelligence, said the most serious threat to your security is cyber attack. Back to the book, Michael. It's all a sea of gray. It's all trade-offs. Nothing's easy. You need to think three or four times before you want to universally weaken the nation's cyber protection, even for very good law enforcement and counterterrorism reasons over here. Right? And so on security grounds, not privacy, not constitutional, on security grounds, I just think it's a bad idea. And we shouldn't do it. Now, the argument I get is it's a one-off, Hayden, don't worry about it. But the longer this goes, the more it doesn't appear to be a one-off. Director Comey's talked about it being used as a precedent. The guy up the Acela line here in Manhattan, Cy Vance Jr., says, I got a room full of these things. And so I don't think it's a one-off. Play it out two and three moves down the board. Let's say the Congress legislates it or the courts hold that Apple's got to bust it. Okay, so this is court order and legislation designed to stop technological progress. I don't think that's a winning hand. I think all it does is push technological progress offshore. If you think it's bad now, that's the worst of all possible worlds. And one more final point. Let's say the government succeeds, right, and we get the right, and Apple is coerced to do this. What is it we do when other governments, for their own quote-unquote legitimate law enforcement needs, now go to Apple, which is a provider in their country, and says, you got to do the same. The Chinese say, these Falun Gong guys break their code. And the Russians pick this. And the Saudis pick a bunch of Shiites. And the Iranians pick a bunch of democratic oppositionists. What's Apple's answer? So hard, fair trade-offs. Good people all around. I shade Apple.
Let's go to the back of the room because I don't want to only reward those in the front. On the right side, and you can pick somebody out. I'm going to ask a question. We're here at the Philadelphia Free Library. Tell this crowd the book of choice of Gitmo detainees. It's in the book.
Oh, I'm sorry. What they like? Oh, Harry Potter. Yeah. We could not keep enough Harry Potter books in the library. Now, not all Gitmo detainees. I'm talking about the 14, eventually 16, remember I said I grabbed two myself, detainees we have at Camp 7. They devoured Harry Potter books, and they complained about the video selection not being as good as it was at the black site.
In the back, in the way back. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you for taking my question. When I was reading your book, General, I saw a clear indication what President Bush was doing in the relationship that your agencies have had with President Bush. I voted for President Obama twice. Yes, I'll admit it. I was the one. And when I started reading what Attorney General Holder was doing and what President Obama were doing in regards to the CIA, and I hear in this current presidential election that one of the candidates is going to continue those policies for another 4 years. How does that play out for our security?
Give me a little more texture.
Okay. Well, number one, they went crazy trying to get you to give them all the files and give them all the information about domestic surveillance and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I got it. Okay. Yeah. So, I spent a lot of time complaining in the book about one aspect of the Obama administration, which is fundamentally about CIA detention and pushing things out. I mean, it has to do with Department of Justice memos, classified IG reports, all put out there. And frankly, I'm summarizing the book now. Frankly, I think Attorney General Holder was a true believer. He actually said there will be a reckoning. And so I actually think he wanted punishment of CIA officers. I don't think President Obama did. My Dear John phone call from the president, you know, it ain't your night, kid. You're not staying on. The president's explanation was, and with you're gone, Mike, it's more easy for me to turn the page and not look back. And I said, Mr. President, I agree with you totally. So I don't think the president had this kind of fire in his belly. That said, and here's the punchline, there is so little difference between the second Bush administration and the Obama administration. Okay, there are bigger changes in counterterrorism action between 43-1 and 43-2 than there are between 43 and 44. I say in the book that I think the president just wanted to create some sort of distinction between himself and his predecessor, and so he didn't get in the way of the attorney general pushing the memos out and, you know, yeah, I may still be doing that targeted killing thing, but I'm not doing this stuff over here, and look how bad that was. And you kind of get this drumbeat as to how bad it was. I develop it a bit more maturely in the book, but that's the cartoon version. But the punchline is the continuity between the two administrations. I mean, the Europeans are stunned. I mean, they give President Obama the Nobel Peace Prize for not being George Bush. And when he goes to Oslo to collect the award, the president quite nobly gives a speech on just war theory and his responsibilities to defend the American nation. There's a magnificent picture of the Nobel Committee looking like they've been texted that their dogs had just been hit by a bus. Because he's there, you know, lecturing on this. There's a great quote in Spiegel after the Snowden revelations. I've forgotten the German, but the German says something along the lines, all along we thought it was George Bush. All along we thought there were two Americas. Now we know there's just one America. Now my point of view is cool. Okay? Because you do have a broadly consensus American approach to the war. I mean, we argue about a lot of things. But again, the punchline I'm trying to pass on to you is continuity rather than distinction.
Were you able to look past President Obama as Senator Obama voting against your confirmation as the director of the CIA?
Oh, that was easy. I think I was approved 82-15. All 15 were Democrats, and all 15 were running for president.
I'm asking the question because the tone of the book, from my perspective, is decidedly negative toward President Obama. Despite the continuity, do say in the book there was greater change, as you just said, between the first and second Bush administration, and it seems as if you resent the fact that candidate Obama said things that President Obama didn't act on, and you almost wish that he'd known better than to say some of the things in campaign season, to which I respond, how could one not know until they're actually in the Oval Office?
So there's a line in the book about security policy looking different from the Oval Office than it does from a hotel room in Iowa, all right? And I give the president credit for adjusting. I do. Where I come down hard and get emotional in reflection to the question here, which was pushing the memos out, reopening investigations of CIA officers that had been opened and judged and shelved by career prosecutors in the Eastern District of Virginia years before. I'm the one who knows who gets called back to the grand jury again and again, even though they thought these matters had been closed. My anger is about the good people at CIA who did tough things, and I get it. Look, I meant what I said when the president says, close the black sites and no more enhanced interrogations. President's given us what we need. March on. And if that were the end of it, that would have been the end of it. But it wasn't.
In similar fashion to you being displeased by those memos, I have to tell you, I disagree with you in this regard. As an American, I feel I'm entitled to read John Yoo's justification for waterboarding. From a legal perspective, I think we're owed that. There were also a number of scores settled in the book relative to journalists, not the least of whom was James Risen for having outed the program to begin with.
What? Not that program. Risen outed a covert action against Iran.
Right.
And the terrorist surveillance program.
And I mean, maybe it just comes naturally. You're a career intelligence guy, and you're hardened against the release of this kind of information.
Yeah, but I also in 60 Minutes, and I mentioned this in the books, but 60 Minutes, when Risen is under great court pressure to reveal his source, who appears to have been Jeffrey Sterling because he was convicted, that I actually said on 60 Minutes Scott Pelley says to me, so do you think Mr. Risen should go to go to jail if he refuses to confirm who his source is. And I said, no. I said, what he did was a bad thing. But the collateral damage to the First Amendment that would be created by jailing a journalist is something I choose not to live with.
One final question from the audience. Way in the back, you there, that individual. Yes, please. Make it a winner.
All right. Thank you, General, for coming to Philadelphia. In respect to North Korea, how much reactionary time does the CIA, NSA, and DIA have with some sort of a heat signature launch from North Korea? And how fast could the South Koreans pick up on that?
Yeah, in terms of...
If you can share that information.
Sure. In terms of technical election, we're fine against the North. They're just so erratic and unpredictable. I mean, North Korea is a pathological little gangster state whose only foreign policy tool is to provoke or threaten provocation. And so you see this cycle. Actually, in other circles, I say it's like a shampoo bottle. You know, provoke, accept concessions, repeat. Provoke, accept concessions. And we've seen this pattern. How to break the pattern. One, the Obama administration used a policy called strategic patience that does not appear to have worked, which is a phrase which means ignore them, right? Actually, I supported it. Oh, there you go. I actually thought that was actually a good response rather than, you know, jumping every time he said boo. But now it appears that he's frustrated with being ignored and he's acting more erratically. So I see two other courses of action. I'm going to try not to be crude here, all right? But we've taught this puppy it's okay to poop on the carpet. Nothing bad happens when he poops. And I think sooner or later somebody's going to have to grab a stack of newspaper and slap him across the snoot.
And so that's not the last image you leave us with, take us out tonight with a little Bob Dylan.
Oh, yeah. I look, it's not a device. I've got popular culture references in there. I got John Cusack and Michigan Town. It'll come to me. And I got Dylan talk. And it's in a chapter called Espionage, Bureaucracy, and Family Life. And I quote Dylan's Blonde on Blonde, two record award-winning album, Middle Side 3. It talks about when you're operating outside the law, you really got to be honest. And the next line is, of course, CIA does not operate outside the law, comma, at least not outside of U.S. law. And again, it comes back, and actually this is great, Michael, because it ties together a theme. It comes back to when you do the things CIA is asked to do, which no one is asked, no one else is asked, no one else is allowed, you're operating in a gray area of legal, political, and ethical ambiguity. You are totally dependent upon the character of your officers. And when you're operating outside the law, you really got to be honest. And hence my anger, and it was genuine anger, that whatever transparency need you felt was being met, Michael, I knew it was going to happen to scores of people who had just done their duty and had already gone through that ringer once and were now being pulled through it again. And so I felt a sense of loyalty to the people. In the book, I talk about we can live with mistakes, and we do, because I was asked by an American financier on a scale of 0 to 10, how would you rate CIA analysis? And my answer was, well, first of all, you got to understand, we don't do 8, 9, or 10. Right? If you get it 8, 9, or 10, they're not asking us. That's going down the street to the Department of Commerce. All right? Okay? We get the very, very difficult things. And so we often, sometimes, fail. And you just have to accept that because we're given very difficult things. We could live with failure, but you can't live with dishonesty, not in this business, because you're operating on such a narrow moral margin. The officer's got to be. I used to go down to, I can't say where we had our field training course for all of our case officers. It's the strangest graduation you would ever see. It's in this big hangar, no family, just us. I'm giving the speech. People walk across the stage to get their diploma. Their names are announced. Bill. George. And I gave a speech. I said, these are case officers, when you recruit someone, you are accepting moral responsibility for the well-being of your source and his entire family. He is putting his life and his family's life in your hand. You may be the only face of America this individual ever sees. Never forget that. And again, back to the really high moral standard that we have to demand, and hence my instinct, Michael, to be very defensive about them.
General Michael Hayden, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks, General. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.